Good morning. I'd like to start by thanking Rabbi Rosendale and the young Yisrael Tomei Emunah of being a gracious host for this lecture, for our lecture series, Jewish Ethics and Sunday morning programs, and all the things that we're so fortunate to do together. Thank you very much. I would also like to thank the young Yisrael office, Mr. Rosenberg, Mr. Cindy Franco, for their help in organizing it, as well as our Director of Community Outreach, Abayam Sinzakam. It's a tremendous honor and pleasure to have Rabbi Moshe Heineman with us again. Rabbi Heineman is a highly regarded as a leading international authority in Jewish halakha, having mastered the intricacies of Jewish law and the complex world of modern technology. Rabbi Heineman is regularly consulted by rabbinic and industrial leaders with in-depth knowledge and practical application of science and religion. Rabbi Heineman's expertise has served him well as rabbinic administrator of the Sarkei, a position he has held since 1971. Rabbi Heineman is also the rabbi of Agudas Yisrael Baltimore, a position he has held since 1981. Here in the Washington-Baltimore area, as you call that, we are personal beneficiaries of Rabbi Heineman, in many ways drawing on his guidance and expertise in matters of kashrut and mitzvah and halach in so many different areas. And it's a great honor and pleasure for us to host him here for this lecture. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce Rabbi Heineman.
Shush Tamar Dasha, Rav Rosenbaum, Rav Winter, Elder Tommy the Chachamim, and everyone else who's here. First, I'd like to wish you a good morning. I appreciate the fact that you've come in such a cold day. I hope you'll get warmed up by what I say. Not because you'd be so angry about what I say, but because you'd be so excited about what I say. Okay, I'm supposed to speak about the implications of genetic engineering. I don't know too much about genetic engineering. So how do I think about it if I don't know anything about it? That's no question. A lot of people speak about things that they don't know anything about. Especially when it comes to Jewish hashkafa. I heard some time ago, I think it was in the year 2000, that they injected a gene from a turkey and put it into a tomato so it should become a better tomato. So the question is, when you eat this tomato, do you become fleshy? Do you have to chef the tomato? What exactly is the halach about it? So we have a rule in Jewish law. If it smells like a tomato, feels like a tomato, tastes like a tomato, sounds like a tomato, then it's a tomato. You make a regular book, you don't want it, you're not precious. What is this? There's a fundamental rule in Jewish law that, let's say you have two letters in the Sefer Torah that touch each other. The Sefer Torah is not kosher. Now what happens if with a magnifying glass you can see that the letters don't really touch, they just look like they touch. the Sefer Torah's Pasuk. What happens if they don't look like they're touching, but with a magnifying glass you see that they are touching? The Sefer Torah's kosher. It doesn't matter what it is. It matters the way that we can perceive it. Before they had magnifying glasses, you mean to say that the Sefer Torah's apostle and now becomes kosher because now we have magnifying glass? No. The Baruch Hu has five senses. We can see, we can hear, we can taste, we can sense of touch, and taste, touch, and smell. Thank you. So, we keep the Torah based on those five senses. If these five senses which the Baruch Hashem gave us tell us it is a certain way, we go by that. Even though that it can be scientifically proven that it's not so. Not only that, but here is something which has long been questioned. It says in Shulchan Aruch, you're not allowed to kill an animal or any living animate thing on Shabbos because it's Netilas Neshama. We learn it out from the Berachas HaMishkan, as a Torah beginning of Parashat Yaakov, which speaks about the construction of the Mishkan, all of a sudden says Sikrat Shabbos. So what does Shabbos have to do with the Mishkan? The answer is that from here we learn out that what's considered a forbidden act on Shabbos, only those things which were used in the Mishkan for the construction of the Mishkan. So since they had these skins, which Eretz Erim Odomim, which they needed for the Mishkan, and you can't get the skin unless you kill the animal first, so therefore killing something is considered in Tzivus Neshama. It is one of the malachas which is asur. So now, the Shulchan Aruch says, now I'll kill an animal. You know, I'll kill a fly. But you're allowed to kill a louse. Why? Because lice are not like regular other insects. They are not bred from a male and female, like everything else is. So therefore, their life is not considered the regular life which the Torah forbade. The Torah only forbade the life of a living thing which is similar to the life which was needed to be terminated for the construction of the Mishkan. Okay, so how do we know that there's no male and female involved with the with life? You look at it. You don't see it's like come all over overnight. You got all these lights. I suppose you have all these lights. These lights crawl around. They look like they come from the dust. Now we know today that that's not true. That they do actually come. The same. It's the same thing. It's not like an amoeba that is a. It reproduces itself without a male and female. So even the plants have male and female. The tree is everything. So the we know it's not true, but it seems to us that they come from the dust, and it seems to us that there's no male and female. That's why we've seen this. We've seen lives already for 5,776 years. And they don't look like they come from male female. So we can go with that. This is an important principle of Torah. Ramosha Feinstein discusses the question about whether you can be Yotze the Kriyas HaMegillah or Havdalah over the telephone. So Ramosha Feinstein says, it depends. What does this telephone do? Does it pull the sound out of the other person's mouth into your ear? Without the phone, you couldn't hear it, but now the phone comes and pulls the sound. Or does it reproduce the sound? Then Rav Moshe Feinstein discusses the question that you have to use a microphone. He says, you're making a new sound. Then he discusses the question of a hearing aid. And he says, are you allowed to speak to someone with a hearing aid? He says, depends. It's the same thing. Are you making a new sound? Does the hearing aid make a new sound? Or is it just pulling the sound out of this person's mouth so you can hear? Well, what is the difference in a microphone and a dial phone? It all seems to be the same type of technology. So how does it make sense? Besides which, you should know, Rav Moshe Feinstein was a genius. He knew, besides knowing Torah all over, besides being the Pesach HaDor, he knew many, many things, quite evident from the Jews. And he knew, just as good as I know, and as good as all of you know, that the telephone reproduces the sound. You can't pull, you don't pull the sound through the wires across the ocean or whatever it is in order to reproduce the sound. It is reproduced. It doesn't shut the sound. So what are you talking about? The answer is, he says, and then he goes on to say, that it seems to be more logical to say that it pulls the sound and not that it reproduces the sound, because if it would reproduce the sound, so then how could you recognize the person's voice? So he says it seems to be more logical to say that it pulls the sound and therefore you're not making a new sound and therefore you could be might be someone else with the Megillah or with the Havdalah. If it's in a Shas HaKakim, it's necessary to rely on that because you're hearing the person. It's not a new sound, you're not hearing the person. So the answer to my questions are as follows. We don't go by what it really is. We go by the way that we can understand it. If in our intellect, which the Baruch Hashem gave us, Seichel, says, with the five senses the Baruch Hashem gave us, we hear the sound, you hear the person talking, you can recognize his voice. It sounds like it just pulls the sound out of the person's mouth and puts it into ear. So even though we know that that's not so, it doesn't matter. And the same way that the Sefer, if it looks to us, for the Sefer Torah is kosher, if the two words seem to be separate, two letters seem to be separated, but with a magnifying glass you can see that they are connected, there's a very thin line that connects them, we go by the way we, our senses help. So if we didn't have any electronic equipment to see that there is electrical impulses go through the wire, we just use our own intellect. One of the senses, so the only one that we can really go by is listening to it. You can't feel anything over here, you can't smell anything over here, you can't see anything over here, or taste anything. It's the only thing we can go by the way we hear it. And it hears exactly the other person's voice. And you can recognize his voice. So therefore, to us, it sounds like his voice is pulled through, and therefore you're hearing from his mouth. And if you're hearing from his mouth, you could be yes to the evidence. Okay. I know someone is no other age, someone's in the hospital, and far away. He's someplace in Iowa in the hospital. So the Rochester, wherever it is, and there's no one around who will be like the Abdullah, you should be yes to Abdullah on the floor. Can't make it yourself. Okay. So this is very important. And so that's why I say you have a tomato that has a gene of a turkey in it. We use our five senses. Does our five senses say that it is a tomato? or is it a turkey? Or it doesn't fly. So that's when you see, when you say one of the senses, you see it, so it doesn't seem to be a turkey. So the all our senses over here, it doesn't sound like a turkey, it doesn't make any noise, it doesn't look like a turkey, it doesn't taste like a turkey, it doesn't smell like a turkey, so therefore it is not a turkey. That's halacha. Okay, now there's something else. We do find, there's Ramban, a very interesting Ramban, in Pasuk Kedoshim, where it says, Rashizra Karmachot Kaloyim. Ovega Kaloyim, Shatvei Zayah Aleph. There are various forms of mixes which are forbidden by the Torah. One of them is Kaloyim. You're not allowed to plant different plants next to each other. There's Kli HaKeren. You're not allowed to plant grains in a vineyard. They have different halachas. In a vineyard, you have to separate four amos. In a chazon, you only have to separate a pesach, or whatever it is. Doesn't matter. There are Klein begotten. Klein, mixture. The Targum, Klein is eruvin. If you mix them, you're not allowed to mix a garment which has linen and the woman's threads in it. So it's written by the Torah. They're Klein behema. You're not allowed to try to get two different animals, a horse and a donkey, and get a mule out of it, it is forbidden by the Torah. Not only that, but if you have, you don't have to have a donkey and a horse pull a wagon for you together, or pull a plow. These are all, these types of mixes which are forbidden. Now the question is, what about this tomato? Are you allowed to mix this tomato? Okay, it is a tomato, but you've actually put something else in here, so is that permitted to do that? The Ramban says the reason why these climbers offer is because the Torah didn't want, the Ramban created the whole world, and he created all different types of animals, but he did not create a mule, which is the offspring of a horse and a donkey. He didn't create a mule. He didn't want a mule. So he didn't create it. If he would have created it, it would have to be a Shezaro Bo that can give off another specimen same as itself. So it speaks about specifically that everything, the Minehu, that it says, even the plants, perhaps the Eshazarbo, they should be able to reproduce itself. Well, a mule can't reproduce itself. It can't have any offspring. So the Ramban says that you see from that the Ramban didn't want it. He didn't create it. So if he created a horse and he created a donkey, he wants there to be a horse and a donkey. He didn't want there to be a mule. So someone who makes, he created wool and created linen, he didn't want this mixture, otherwise he would have made a mixture. So I saw in the Sefer a question about whether you're allowed to wear polyester clothing. Why, what's polyester have to do with this? Because wool, which the bones are created, goes on a sheet, she's supposed to warm. Linen, which the Ramban created, keeps the person cool. It's worn in the summer. So if Ramban had prepared clothing to keep you warm, and clothing to keep you cool. But if you, what happens in the fall and in the spring, it's not hot and it's not cold. What did Ramban create for that? Ramban didn't create anything for it. So now if you go and you combine it, you're doing something against Rotsen of the Rebbe Shalom, against the will of the Rebbe Shalom. So it is a severe avera to wear Shabbos. So someone asked the question, well, polyester you can wear in the summer, you can wear in the winter. In the summer it keeps you cool, in the winter it keeps you hot. So therefore maybe you don't have to wear it. Okay. So I don't think there's any problem with polyester. I'm not arguing with the Rambam. The Torah has specifics what is forbidden. So the Torah says, Kleisroim, if you take different plants, and you plant them together in the vicinity of each other within a pepper, you're not allowed to do it, and progress will become forbidden. The Torah forbade it, but it's only in Eretz Yisrael that Kleisroim is offered. In Chutz La'aretz there is no Kleisroim. Klai Ilon, if you have a tree, you take a branch of a plum tree and you put it into an apple tree, it's forbidden. But that's forbidden in Chutz La'aretz also. So if, I'm not questioning what the Rambam says, but what I'm saying is that if the Rambam didn't want Kleisroim, then it should be off everywhere. So evidently there are certain parameters what you're allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do. And we learn everything out of the Torah. And if it's not forbidden, it's mutter. That's the wonderful thing about the Torah. Whatever new invention comes out, there's going to be a halacha about it. How do I know that? Simple. They are now on the verge of producing electric appliances that instead of having to bother yourself to press the button, you can just think that it should go on and it will go on. They have it already, but it's not in mass production. So the question is, if you have a washing machine and you put everything in, the wash and everything, the whole Shabbos, but you forgot to press the button. Are you allowed to think on Shabbos that the washing machine should go on and it'll go on or not? Okay, so I think this is already, Chazal is talking about everything. It says, Chafotecha Asurim, that what you want to do on Shabbos is also, the Gamblach says, you know, now he's trying to figure out how much money you owe. Harhorim Mutarim, you're allowed to think about it. So it says there in the foolish in the news, Harhorim Mutarim, the other thing, it's not considered a malacha on Shabbos. Now sometimes the Chacham will come along and say, even though it's permitted by the Torah, it's not Shabbosic to start your washing machine on Shabbos, so therefore the Chacham may answer. But they didn't answer this. And even though they may have done it had they been here, but since they didn't do it, it's very much it. The Chacham tells like this. An apple. Are you allowed to eat an apple? The Torah doesn't speak about it. It doesn't mention anything about an apple. This is a misconception to think that Chava gave on reason an apple was not an apple. Matter of fact, the apple is not mentioned anywhere in the Torah, and it does speak about in the Chazal, Tapuach, Vayorach, Esreach, Vagodav, Vayvar Chehu, that Yitzchak smelled the smell of the garments of Esav, and he gave him a bracha. He gave him a bracha. So Rashi says that it was Reach Gan Eden. Other Chazal say, Kusodah Shel Tapuchen. So the person says, Tapuchen is an asterisk. Tapuach really means something which is blown up, a big fruit. That's what Tapuach means. So today they use it to mean apple. But it wasn't an apple. The Machlok is what it was. There's four opinions in the Gemara about what was this fruit that she gave it to eat. But none of them are an apple. So how do you know that apples they got to eat? He was unreasonable to eat the apple. He didn't have anything that was forbidden to him except to eat from this tree. But how do you know an apple's water? The answer is, if the Torah doesn't say that it is forbidden, automatically it is permitted. So therefore, if they'll come out with a new machine, a new car, that goes by itself, you just have what they have already. Which you just sit in there, you punch in the place you want, the address you want to go to, and it goes by itself. It goes by itself, it has sensors on either side. If there's a car there, it won't move. It goes by itself. What's the halacha with it? If it's not forbidden, it's going to be mutter. That's it. So how do we know it's forbidden or not? Okay, so that you need a tamachacha to know what's involved. You have to know actually someone knows what's involved with the car. You've got to press the button to start it. So they also make it, you don't have to even be matriarch, bow yourself to press the button. But in the meantime, we're still holding in the cave man's land, but you still have to press buttons over here. Can you press this button? So what are you doing? So you know, when your car works on gasoline, the ones we have over here in America. They work on gasoline, or they work on different types of gas, or they work on electricity. But it works on sparks. They have spark plugs in a car, and it causes an explosion. And that's what causes the motor to work. Okay, so you have that. You have your cooking. The water in the radiator, if it is a water-cooled motor, which is when you put the brake line goes on, so then you're making a new circuit, and there's a light. There are various things which, of course, the car goes down the Rishus HaRavim, and then you consider carrying the car, even though that it is on the ground, doesn't matter, it is considered carrying. So, of course, you have to know a little bit about a car in order to be able to pop it on a car. But I don't have to know too much about genetic engineering and about how they get the gene out of the nucleic acid and how they deliver it to whichever place they're going to put it in. Usually with a virus, like the AIDS virus they typically use, that's one of the good things about this AIDS virus, that it's used to deliver genes, because the virus gets into every cell of the body, and that's how it gets in. So there's going to be a lot about this genetic engineering. So now the question is it mutter because you're now doing something which the Russian didn't want or not? So this is the question that we've got to ask ourselves. So the answer to that question is that even though it is true that the Torah says that there are certain forms of kliyim, certain forms of something which are different, but the Torah doesn't say that you're not allowed to make a brick out of a combination of sand and silicone or mud, the Torah doesn't talk about it. The Torah doesn't talk about it, it is permitted. As far as I know, the Torah doesn't speak about anything about genetic engineering, and so therefore it would be permitted. Now, if it falls in the category of something else which is mentioned in the Torah, so then that's a different story. So if it falls in the category of something forbidden, it will be forbidden. But what happens if you have the most of the genetic engineering which is used today primarily is to in food, is in plants like soybeans and other plants to make them more resistant to disease and make them resistant to insect infestation. So how do they do that? So they see that there's one plant someplace in Ecuador, some other country, that there's no, it doesn't get infested by insects. Not everything is infested by insects. So they, what is it in this plant that insects don't like? So they have to make a bishokhatira, they look into it to try and find out what it is. And then they've got to get it out of their the DNA, the genes are part of the DNA, which actually the genes are just information which tells the DNA how to reproduce and how to, and what they should be. So the thing gets out and put it into soybeans, then this soybean will also be it won't be an attraction for insects, might repel them. There may be some smell in it which we can't even smell, but the insects can smell, and that's what keeps away. It may be something that has a slightly a different taste, which we can't feel, but the insects can feel it, and therefore they don't feel comfortable with it. There could be many reasons why the insects don't grow. So it helps this plant grow. The insects don't eat it. The insects stay away from it. It's more customer friendly, and that's what they do mostly for disease and for to make the plant more wholesome. That's what it's mostly used. But if it would give a taste into it, then let's say this turkey gene would give a taste of a turkey. So then there's a new question over here. That we have if you take a chasa and you cook it in a pot, you take the pot and you clean it out with collards and steel wool, it's perfectly clean. And now you want to use it for kosher meat, you cannot do it. The meat's going to be not kosher. Because the Torah already says that if you have an earthenware keli and you cook in something which is nicer or whatever, so then you have to break it. There's no way you can get that taste out of it completely. Then the clean of chayshes rushala, if you cook it in a copper vessel, umarak rushut habamayim, you should cook up water in it, and then the taste will go out into the water, and then it will be okay. Why? Because there are spaces in a copper keli. Any metal keli, there are pores in it. So a regular person doesn't see them. So we're not worried about them, you can't see them. But when you taste it, if the taste comes out from the walls of the pot and it goes into the food, it becomes trace. And therefore, if you cook something kosher in it, after you cook something trace, the kosher food becomes trace. Tamka ikka, the taste of it is like the thing itself. So if by putting in this turkey gene and tomato, you would taste turkey, then it would be trace. Not because it is a turkey, but because you have the taste of the turkey in it. And so it's just like cooking in a pot. Now there are some cases where we say that even though there's no taste, there it is trace anyway. For instance, let me backtrack for a minute. Cheese. Cheese is permitted food. Why do I question whether cheese is permitted? How is cheese made? Cheese is made through bacteria. And they make it, they take the milk jars and they coagulate and they become cheese. So this bacteria is a living organism. You can see them with a microscope. And the cheese is full of these bacteria. And we'll have to eat it. For the same reason I mentioned before. Because you can only see with a microscope. Without them, you can't see. You don't have to chef the cheese. You don't have to wait 6 hours after you eat the cheese. It's made from milk and like milk. There was a case. There was some Rama Maksha who was doing a hefshah on some bread, and they had a question. So they were using a certain type of ingredient, which it had a kosher reputation for this roast. They were using a certain ingredient, which was always powered. And now, all of a sudden, the company changed, and the hefta on it was under the OU. The OU said it's OUD, dairy. And they didn't realize it was the same product they've been using for years. It was a flavor enhancer. So it is like salt, so it's a flavor enhancer. And they used it by mistake. So now it was a very big bakery. So he said to me, is there any way that we can say it's okay? It's not a question of just dairy. If you make bread with milk, the bread is actually trace. Not that it's not just that it is milky. So this was the question. The question is, do they have to recall all of it, and how are they going to recall it? And there was a lot of implications over here that it's going to be traced. Is there any hefta? So I said, we can't taste it because it is traced. So I said, can you get a professional guy, a taster, that will taste it and ask and find out if it has any taste of milk in it? If there's no shishim. So if it's part of the shishim, it will be okay. If there was no shishim, it was 50 times as much as that. So I said, get a guy a taster and taste it, and then come back to me. Well, it's going to tell him the following. That we don't rely on a guy. The Sadim do, but the Ashkenazim don't rely on a guy to say if it is what it tastes like. Because according to the Sadim, if the guy says, and he's a professional, and he says that it has no taste, we can rely on him and they can eat the bread. But the Ashkenazim don't rely on this. And so therefore I said, get a guy to do it. My intention was that after the guy has tasted it and says that there is no taste of milk in it, so then we'll go to get a scribe to taste it, because he's allowed to rely on the Shulchan Aruch. And if he says that it doesn't have any taste, so then we can rely on the Jew. So therefore it will be milk in it. That was my intention. Okay, so they got a taster from a tea company. His job was to taste tea. He did that the whole day. He was such a bucky in tea that he said that if you give him tea, he can tell you within 5 miles where this tea was grown. This kind of a bucky. So he tastes it, and he says, it has a buttery taste. Okay, so that whole heck went out of it, thrown out of the window. Then in such a case, if it would have a taste of a turkey, then we have, it actually would be glacic. You don't have to check with tomato, but it would be glacic, and you wouldn't have to wait 6 hours, but you couldn't eat it together with the milk itself. But we find there are different types of cows. I don't know if you know this. There are milchic cows and fleshic cows. Milchic cows are the ones that give the milk. The fleshic cows are the ones that give the meat. So what am I talking about? What's that really? Milchic cow. All cows have, female cows have milk. No. There are cows, they're called Holsteins, that a cow can give 20 pounds of milk, it's supposed to be pounds at a time. Tremendous amount of milk, so maybe 7 gallons, whatever it is, at a time. They have been them, they've been bred. So like you have, the Rosh made counts. I don't think that he made all these different types of cows we have today. He made one type of cow. One of these cows gave more milk than the other. So then they bred this cow, and for the next generation of calves, there was one cow that gave more milk than the other. So then they bred this one. Until they came to this Holstein cow, which you can tell that has white back, black blotches all over it. The bones on the back stick out. The more they stick out, the better milk it is. Since the Holstein cows are used primarily for milk, then before they die, they send them to the slaughterhouse. You can't really eat this meat because it's too tough. And it's not a fresh cow, it is a milk cow. And it's used for hamburgers. You have to grind it up. Because if you have to chew it, you'll be chewing them from one day to the next till you get it. So they have grind it up. They use it for hamburgers. They could use it in salami. They could use it in bologna. Other things that count. Fleshier cows are used as bread for their meat. They're not big milkers, and the females are not big milkers. It's the quality of the meat which is important. So you have the Black Angus cows, which have certain properties, but they have a problem. They come originally from Scotland. Their problem is that you can't breed them in the south. Where it gets too hot, they die. I want to tell you something about a cow that maybe you don't know. A cow does not sweat. It doesn't sweat. Can't sweat. It's not designed to sweat. That's why the skin of a cow is used for parchment. Because if they would sweat and there'd be small holes in the parchment, when you write, it won't be able to write perfectly because the ink would get into the holes. So they have no holes. So how does it keep cool? We have pores in our skin, and we keep cool because it evaporates, the fluid that we have in our body evaporates, it keeps us cool. When it gets real hot, we start sweating because there's more liquid which is coming out, and we need more liquid to evaporate in order to keep cool. Because in order to evaporate, it has to take the heat from the body, and so that's right. So how does a cow keep cool? The answer to that is because it keeps cool by breathing in air. It breathes in the cool air, and that way the cool air gets into the lungs and it cools off the blood. And then when it breathes out the hot air, and that's where it keeps cool. Dogs are like that also. It's funny to see a dog like that. That's because it keeps stuff cool. The horse sweats. They can't use horse hide for riding on, something for riding. So these Black Angus cows, they come from Scotland. They can keep themselves cool by breathing and breathing out, because in Scotland it never gets that real hot. But once you get temperatures which are over 98, 99 degrees, by the way, the normal temperature of a cow is 102. It's not 98 like a human being. So therefore, as long as the weather is beneath that, it can keep itself cold, cool. But once it gets above that, they will die. You can't take it. So therefore, if you want to breed animals in the hot, it's a different type of cow. It's called a Brahma. A Brahma cow can take the heat. It has a more effective way of cooling itself, and it'll take the heat. A Brahma cow, if you've ever seen them, they have a hump on the back of the neck somewhat, which is not edible. It's full of fat and tissue, but that's a Brahma cow. Now, if you want to, it doesn't taste good. The meat doesn't taste good from Obama. Nothing compared to the cows which we have over here in the northern United States. So when you put a Brahma together with an Angus, now it's some of these characteristics of one with the other are going to change. It may be able to take the heat. It may be able to make the meat taste better. And this is being done all over. I mean, this is cross breeding. There's different types of cows. Also, there is a certain type of cow which can produce more. It's called a limousine. Called limousine, without an ear at the end. A limousine cow. This cow has a tremendous advantage. The regular cow, you have to give them 7 pounds of feed, so it should gain 1 pound. But this one, you give them only 6 pounds of feed, and it will make a pound of meat. So you can understand already for yourself that this is something which is commercially very viable, and everyone wants that trait. So they crossbreed them, and they come up with a new type of cow, which is a crossbreed, which sometimes has all the bad features of all of them, sometimes has all the good features of all of them, sometimes has some, doesn't have the other. So this is being done, and we don't have a problem over here of clients, because they're all the same men. They're the same species. They're all cows. As I said, that I believe that when the Baruch Shem made cows, he didn't make all these different types of cows. They're all cows. And they eventually, because of mutations and whatever other reason, they developed into different types of cows. So therefore, even though the Torah says any two species, you're not allowed to crossbreed, but if they're the same species, you're allowed to do it. And the same thing with all plants. And the Rambam goes into great detail to know, how do you know the difference between a grass seed and a wheat kernel? Wheat is a type of grass. So are you allowed to crossbreed them or not? Because it implies run. Run goes into explain if the leaves are different, the shape is different, whatever it is, there to know are they different species or they're not different species. And the Mishnah and Klein goes into great length, try to show whether it is a different species or not. And it says these are not. Many of them we don't know exactly what they are anymore today, so that's a different problem. It's interesting. How much are you, do you have to eat matzah on Pesach? A kazayis. Everyone knows that. You need a kazayis. Why didn't the Torah say that a kazayis is 2 fluid ounces, 1 fluid ounce? Why is that such an obscure thing? Kazayis, we've got to try and figure out what a kazayis is. A kabeza, so the esrog has to be the size of an egg. So what egg is there? Is it a small egg? Is it a medium egg? Is it a large egg? Is it a jumbo? What egg? Why does it give us such difficult ways of figuring out how much an amma is? So it's why do you say 18 inches, 20 inches, whatever. Well, it's much simpler. Okay, so I'll tell you that's easily answered. My Rosh Hashiva, Rabban Kotler Zekatel Zrocha, who was a Rosh Hashiva in Lakewood, he was once asked, and I was there when they asked him this question, 10 tefachim, which is a shiur of a machitza of a Shabbos, in order to make it into a shiur yachid or whatever. How high is it? He said, I don't know if you know Yiddish. If you don't know Yiddish, it doesn't make any difference. 20 vashkas. 20 vashkas. Vashkas? What's vashkas? No one knew what vashkas was. So I saw in the paper at Paris Mines that it also thinks about these vashkas, and he says a vashka is 2 inches. Okay, but here's the point. If the Torah would say a measure, after a while, these measures are not used anymore, we wouldn't know what it is. So the Torah speaks about things that are there in every generation. An amma, the distance between the end of your finger to your elbow. Tfachim, with a fist, with the four fingers of a fist, are there in every generation. As long as they're human beings, there's going to be tzvachim and there's going to be amos. There's always going to be eggs, unless chickens become extinct. There's always going to be a kazayas. There's always going to be a kazayas. Now, of course, now we've got to figure out what kind of egg. So then we actually go by the average egg, which is in America, which is not a medium egg. It's a large egg. Why is that? Colgate toothpaste comes in three sizes. Large, giant, and economy. So which one is the medium one? The giant is the medium one. So just because you call this a medium egg, try and get a four egg. Go into the supermarket and see if you get a four egg. Can't get it. No one wants small eggs. That has a bad name. That doesn't sound good. So they call the small medium, and they call the medium large, and they call the large jumbo, extra large, whatever it is. So, but for what is available, you take the one which is which is the average, and that is the average egg which we're dealing with, because they're always available, and we always know what we're talking about. So all the shrimp of the Torah are all like that. A Grogus for Shabbos and Tesedas for Yom Kippur. These are all things in nature which are there, going to be there forever. Okay, so why am I saying this? So, I don't remember what I'm saying. Went off on a tangent. Okay. So the Torah deals and the shear of a kazayas or a kabaya can change and does change from one generation to the other. If today a medium egg, the large egg is different in size than the larger egg of 100 years ago, we go with the one in our day. Because that's our lover. That's what the Torah is saying. This is a living Torah. And you can't say, we know that people today are taller than they were in the Middle Ages. How do we know that? Because we have their suits of armor, which they used to wear. So it's simple. You know, if the metal doesn't change in its height if you keep it for a long time. So it's about the same. So therefore, we know that people were not as tall. So therefore, the armor today is not the same as the armor that used to be in the Middle Ages. And not only that, but you know that they found a ship on the top of Mount Ararat in Turkey. And someone got an idea that maybe this ship, what's the ship doing on top of a mountain? You put ships on top of a mountain, you usually put ships in the water. Why is it doing over here? Someone's got an idea. Maybe this is the Taylor's Nerf, the ark that Nerf built. Because it says in the Torah that it landed on Torah Aurora. So maybe this Mount Ararat is it. So they decided that they're going to make an investigation, scientific investigation. So the problem is, the top of a mountain, as you know, is snow, and this mountain's full of ice, and it was buried in the ice, but you could see through the ice with the floor of the ship. So they bored through the ice, and they took a sample from the wood to see how old it is. So when the lab came back with the results, they said, we can't tell how old it is because this wood has been saturated with tar. And once it's saturated with tar, you can't tell anymore how old the wood is. Okay, so like it says in the Torah, we buy from a chutzpah kaifa, you should put tar on it. So we still haven't proven if it is another table or not. However, now here comes the point. The Torah says that the teva is 30 amos long, 50 amos wide, 30 amos in a height. It's 100 by 50 by 30. So now we don't have any question anymore how big an amma is. We'll just measure the paper, and then we'll know exactly. Because the Torah said how big it is. One help. Because even though enough times the amma was that size, today it may be something completely different. Because we go by the amma of today in every dar. So it won't help anything. Of course, they couldn't prove it that it wasn't that seichel, that it's anyone with only 2 cents worth of seichel in his head was able to figure out that that it's the seichel of math, especially since it was impregnated with tar. That's a bigger proof that it was the seichel of math. But what I'm saying is that we have different things that we are allowed to, we have engineered products, which all have been engineered in nature. We don't say if the Gonson didn't create cheese, so then you're not have to eat the cheese, because it's made that with, you have to put rennet in the cheese, you have to put a culture in the cheese, and you need the bacteria to make it. We don't say that. The Torah didn't forbid it, and the Torah didn't forbid it, so then it's mutter. So the same thing is with this genetic engineering, it is permitted, and you're allowed to do it. The result, the product, as long as it doesn't have any taste of the thing which they put into it, which it doesn't have, but if it would have, so then we would have this question of, then there would be actually a question that has a taste, that it may be forbidden depending on what they put into it. And otherwise, we say that you're out to eat it. And since you're allowed to eat it, so it doesn't fit into the category of the Ramban, it's like polyester clothing. Surgeons say it's also, it is nothing. I want to thank everyone for listening to me, and does anyone have any questions? Yes?
What about if you have the fashion of fake shrimp? If you make great, I understand most fake shrimp make bacon, an expert would be able to tell the difference and say, no, this is just something the store looks like. What if they keep improving and improving and improving so that
okay, so you're referring to bacon bits, is that right? Okay, but you know you can get bacon bits with a hefshah. Okay, so evidently they must feel that it's okay. It is okay, as long as the Gemara says that everything that is traced has something kosher which the Torah permitted, which has the same taste. It was the same. Because the Torah didn't want to limit a person that he shouldn't benefit from all the pleasures of this world. So the Baruch Shem says, so there's a chazah, which is at this point is forbidden, even though that there's a chazal that says, Lama Nikra Shmei Chazir, why is it called a chazah? She'ofer HaKadosh Baruch Hu Lachzir Yisrael, in the future, chazah will be permitted. That future is here already, because I'm not chassid on saying you're not eating chassid today, but they found a pig in India that looks like a pig, smells like a pig, it acts like a pig. It's a pig. The only thing is that this pig is Malagera and not chassid pasta. So the so that's what the Chazal probably means, that also Kodesh Baruch Yisrael, that there's going to come a time when there will be a kosher pig. Because the only reason why it says, it's actually said clearly in the Torah, that's a Chazir. Ki mafis pasahu v'loy gera tamehu lachem. The Torah says clearly, the only reason why the Chazir is also, because it doesn't chew the cud. So if it would chew the cud, so then it would be mutter. That's what it says in the Torah, right? So therefore, we have that. It's not, at this point, doesn't taste too good, so therefore people are not cultivating it. But there could be a time when they can improve the taste, maybe with genetic engineering. maybe it will become, but Chas V'Shalom, nothing changes in the Torah. The Torah is here forever. But this says clearly in the Torah that it will become permitted. So the so as long as all the ingredients in it are kosher, so then it is kosher. Now there is a ethical question. You're going to give a heksha to bacon bits, it doesn't sound right. So we had a company that asked us if we could make them kosher pasta, elbow macaroni, kosher pasta, elbow macaroni with noodles. So he said, if there's no hummus in it, we could do that. There's no flour in it at all, no wheat in it. We did it, we went to the company, it took us a week to clean out the 24-hour cleaning crew. We had a few mushrooms there to see that it's completely clean, everything. We took care of it. We made 500,000 pounds of this stuff. Before we had already finished making it, it was all sold already. So we tried to figure out which person wants to have elbow macaroni at his state of on his state of place. Who's buying all this? It didn't make any sense. So just for our own curiosity, we tracked down the distributor, even though it's not our business to do this, so we don't usually do this, but just such a surprising thing. And we found out that most of it, the overwhelming majority of it, was sold in Bar Park. So we called up some of the people in Bar Park and said, what's the matter with you? Why would you buy this stuff? They said, we don't eat it on Pesach. We give it to our children to eat before Pesach so they shouldn't make the house homesick. This is where it was sold. But we didn't have such a problem about producing kosher Pesach macaroni. We didn't have a problem with that. We thought that people couldn't read the ingredients because there's no flour in it at all, so we think we'll get away with it. But I remember we had a restaurant in the 70s, early 70s, and they came out with powdered milk. So they wanted to know if they could use the fish for a restaurant, can they use the powdered milk? So we said, the only way you can use the powdered milk, it was called Parvin, I think, is if you leave it in the container, and then you could, because the container says it's powdered milk, so then people know it's powdered milk. A restaurant doesn't put out containers. Everything's in pitchers and jars, silver, whatever, it looks like silver. We can't do that. I said, you can't do it, so don't sell it. Finally, they served it in the container. So they did that for a few years. After 10 years, I said to them, they didn't ask me anything. I said, you don't need it in the container anymore. But that was the beginning, what was a new thing. And so people thought that what's going on over here, so you need the container to explain that. Now there's such a common thing already, so you don't need it anymore. When Rokeach made a soap, kosher soap. Now, if any of you remember what it looked like, there was the word kosher written on in the bar. And they went and they asked Rav Yisrael Chanon if they're allowed to, who was the person who was there, if they're allowed to put out with kosher soap. Because before there was never no kosher soap. All kosher soap was made with animal fat. Even today, soap is generally made with animal fat, unless you have a special type of soap. So they were afraid that people will think that you have to use any soap. So Yisrael Chanon said that if you put the word kosher on the bar in such a way that the word kosher stays on that bar all the way until you finish the bar, so then you could do it. So they did that. As a matter of, the word kosher goes all the way through the bar. It is not just on the top, and when you use it, it was gone. So they did that because of that reason. But today, the people know that such a thing is kosher soap. The new one, the guessing soap, doesn't have a kosher on it at all. And it has it on the package, but you don't usually use the soap with the when it's in the package. You should take it out of the package before you use it. So it's not any problem anymore. So I told them you don't need it anymore, because now the same thing with bacon bits. When they started out, so maybe there was a question whether you can do it or not. But today, there's no problem anymore. I know there's one company that came to us that they wanted to, I'm not wrong, but they wanted to have a heksha on dog food. kosher dog food. So I said, you don't need a hefshar on dog food. It's no problem. So they said, we want a hefshar on dog food. Not that you don't need it. We think that we can sell much more dog food if we even get a kosher nut. So we wouldn't do it. We felt, this is making a joke out of kashrus. A joke out of kashrus. That you give a hefshar on dog food. So we refused to do it. Now there is a question about dog food for Pesach, and that's a different issue, because if it has chametz in it, you can't even give it to your animal. You don't have to benefit from it. Now to have it, you don't have to own it. So that's a different story. But the general hefshar, which is what they wanted, as a matter of fact, there came out an article in the psychiatrist magazine. A psychiatrist that had a dog over there with a big yarmulke and curly tails on the side. So they wanted to, when they found out about this dog food for kosher dog food, they said, like, it's the cycle of people, you know, who think that it's kosher, it's better. Which maybe it is, but it doesn't necessarily mean it tastes better. Just the same way that regular milk will get sour if you leave it standing around. Call your soul gets sour the same way. Any other questions? Yes. If the bugs are that small that you cannot see them with a naked eye, then it is not a bug. Now, that's a little bit of a general statement, but you see, some people can see better and some people can see worse. So you go after average sight of a person. So in order that you shouldn't miss anything, some people like to use a light box on the bottom because it's easier to see. Holding up to the light of the sun is a natural phenomenon. You don't need any special equipment for that. And if you could see it that way, you are required to do that. So but if you can't see it even there, then it's not forbidden. All bacteria that way, we eat bacteria all the time. And because you can't see it.
The idea of the shiurim changing every generation to honor the provider. Why do you find the sources where they talk about, well, the eggs got smaller, therefore we can't go by our eggs? Do you find that?
Okay, I think I can handle that question. The question is like this. There's a difference in between the poskim. Whether when something is the size of an egg, if the shear is an egg, do we go with our eggs or do we go by the eggs through the time of Chazal? Because maybe our eggs got smaller from what they used to be. Okay, so let me say the following. If the shear, if the shear is an egg, it doesn't matter if it got bigger, it doesn't matter if it got smaller, like an esser. If the eggs got smaller, the shear of the esser got smaller. If the eggs got bigger, the shear of the esser is going to get bigger too. But the problem is that we have a shear of a kazayat. Now, even though the Torah says, I saw a tremendous, so is machlokes, how big a kazayat is, most persons say it's about the size of a half an egg, and around them says it's the size of a third of an egg. There's a question about our eggs, how big they're supposed to be. I saw a tremendous chiddush in the Chaz Mish. Did you know what the size of a kazayat is? It's the size of an olive. But the problem is, with the size of an olive, that they're Italian olives, they're Spanish olives, they're Greek olives, they're olives that grow in Eretz Yisrael. And in many countries, they're not the same. Which olive are we talking about? And besides that, our olives are relatively small. I have a feeling, even though maybe I'm wrong, that if you leave one tree longer, it'll get bigger. Except that when they get bigger, they don't taste as good. So therefore, with the ones that we get over here, only the small ones. But since so we don't know anymore what size of olive we're talking about, so the Rishonim say that it's the size of a half an egg. Rambam says a third of an egg, of our egg. But since it's not the shear of an egg, the shear of a kazayas is a kazayas, so then if our eggs are not the same size as they were in former generations, then that designation doesn't hold anymore, because it has to be the shear of a kazayas. If the Lacha Moshe Nisim is an egg, it depends on our egg. And that's the whole question over here. It's basically a question of a kazayas. Now, how did all of a sudden we think that the eggs got smaller today from what they used to be? Why would we think such a thing? Why don't we say that they're the same? And if anything, since they're cultivating eggs, maybe they got bigger now. Why would we say they got smaller? There's a reason for that. Because it says in the... I know I'm holding you over time. It's supposed to be most of me, so I can answer your question. The mikra is 40 saw. So how do you figure 40 saw? So the Chazal say it's ama al ama berum gimel ama. Three cubic ama is the shear of 40 saw. Says Megillah. Now, okay, so you see the shear of an ama and you have three cubic ama. Chazal also say that there are six bayim in a lug, and four lug in a kav, and six kavim in a sah, which means 144 eggs in a sah, and 40 sah in the shear of a mikvah. Now, when you figure that out, and you figure out the shear, the other one, the one with the when you figure out with the eggs. Is half the size, approximately. Today it's a little bit more than that, but in those days it was half the size. And so there's some inconsistency over here. It should be the same. So no view to say it from here is evident that either the people got bigger today, or the eggs got smaller, in order that you're able to figure out, so he shows that they didn't get bigger. And so it must be the eggs got smaller. That's why he came to this conclusion. So it only applies to things which the real shear is not the shear of an egg. So if the shear is the shear of an egg, so then it'll be the same as the eggs of today and the eggs of those days, as I said before. Okay, you take one more question. Yes. You have a what?
A new kind of
salmon. Right. You're definitely allowed to eat it. The bracha will be the same bracha like you make on regular salmon, shakol mi'etzoro. As long as it has fins and scales, so then, because the non-kosher fish doesn't have scales, Maya fins does not have scales, so when after you put the gene in, if it still has fins and scales, it's kosher. Kosher is clearly anything that has fins in the water that has fins and scales is kosher. It doesn't matter. It has. Now, you've been following what I've been saying. Thank you for that. This is one person who's listening to what I'm saying. And it will definitely be a kosher fish, and you can eat it. Okay, well, I want to thank everyone again, and I wish you a warm winter day.
Winter.